I'd think about my favorite novels, The Great Gatsby, David Copperfield, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, The Catcher in the Rye, and their brilliance would paralyze me. You guys, that was a quote from The Tender Bar by J.R. Moringer. Okay, he's talking about his favorite novels, and he says, their brilliance would paralyze me. That's how I felt about this book. This is the best memoir that I've read so far. I can never write a book as good as this. I feel too many things about this book. I don't even know where to begin. In the first pass, let me tell you about what I did in the first recording. I basically would just read lengthy passages because I loved them. And then I would be like, wasn't that so good? And then I'd be like, this reminds me of my life. Let me tell you why. And there was no actual like talking about the writing. So this time I went back through, I studied the actual writing, and I tried to figure out what he did to make it resonate with me so much. And what can I replicate? And how can I replicate it? Because that's the thing that's going to help me write my memoir. Not being like, oh my God, this is so good. So I've been talking about how much I love this book. And so then people are like, oh, should I read it? And it's like, I don't know if you should read it. I mean, I think yes, because I think the writing is beautiful and its brilliance paralyzed me. But also his story just reminded me such of my own life that I just saw myself in the book. Let's talk about J.R. Moringer. I have mentioned him before in a previous podcast. He was the ghostwriter for a bunch of memoirs. He did Andre Agassi's Open, Phil Knight's Shoe Dog, and Prince Harry's memoir, which the title just, I just forgot it. I don't know the name of his book. The first time I ever read something by J.R. Moringer was this New Yorker piece he did earlier this year called Notes from Prince Harry's Ghostwriter. I read the piece on my phone, and it was pretty long, and I ended up sitting down and reading it straight through. As soon as I finished it, I was just so blown away by the writing that I had to read it again. And then the next day, I uploaded it into my Readwise reader, and then I started taking notes. After that, I was like, who is this guy? And that's when I found out that he was the ghostwriter for all these other people. And then I found out that he wrote his own memoir, which is this one, The Tender Bar. And so the only reason I wanted to read this book was because I loved his writing. I knew nothing about the story. So what is this book about? Well, there's a bunch of different storylines. One of the big storylines is about a father-son relationship. He had an absent father. Another is about the mother-son relationship. She was obviously raising him on her own. It's also about his college experience at Yale and eventually working at the New York Times. But for me, the storyline that resonated the most was a story about a bar he loved. A bar where his Uncle Charlie worked and a bunch of other characters who worked there and frequented the bar. And it was this place to him that felt like home. This reminds me of my life because I worked at a bar, let's call it the Masonry. I worked at the Masonry from about age 28 to 32. This was a very formative time of my life. I had recently moved to LA. During the time that I worked at this bar, I broke up with my boyfriend of 8 years, which meant I was single for pretty much the first time at 30 years old for about a year. And then I dated another guy for 7 months, who I thought I was going to marry, by the way. And then I was single again. And during this time was all when I was working at the Masonry. And I met my people here. I also started doing a lot of drugs and drinking excessively. I mean, I was kind of drinking excessively before, but I took it to a whole new level here. So, okay, let's just start with the beginning of the book. Okay, the prologue, these are the opening lines about the bar, and I'm just going to read this passage to you. He writes, "We went there for everything we needed. We went there when thirsty, of course, and when hungry, and when dead tired. We went there when happy, to celebrate, and when sad, to sulk. We went there after weddings and funerals, for something to settle our nerves, and always for a shot of courage just before. We went there when we didn't know what we needed, hoping someone might tell us. We went there when looking for love, or sex, or trouble, or for someone who had gone missing, because sooner or later, everyone turned up there. Most of all, we went there when we needed to be found." This is the opening lines, and as soon as I read this, I was like, yes, this was exactly how I felt about the Masonry. It was my favorite place. And if you noticed, there was a ton of repetition here. In fact, The beginning of every line starts with, we went there. We went there for everything we needed. We went there when thirsty. It reads like a poem. It's got this like lyrical sound to it. There's also some opposites. So happy and sad, weddings and funerals. It has this very satisfying sound to it. And it's also very relatable. But knowing that I've gone through this experience and that I love that place so much, I know that there is a dark side to this too. Eventually, I had to leave the bar. I was drinking too much. I was doing too many drugs too frequently. I considered like, okay, I love these people so much, so I don't want to leave. But I knew that if I was walking through those doors, that I would still be doing those things. Like I couldn't be there and not partake in the drugs and alcohol. It was too appealing, too comfortable, too easy, too normal. Like everybody was doing it. It's not like people were like, okay, come on, Bleak, let's go do this. It was just that I just felt like too inside of it that I wanted to do it. So I'm going to talk about something else that I promise will relate to this. Up until that point in my life, my number one mission was to be skinny. To be skinny was to achieve happiness because it would make me feel confident, loved, valued, respected. At least that's how I felt at the time. I thought that being skinny would be the answer to all of my problems. And it just so happens that the drugs helped a lot with achieving that goal. At one point during this time, I was broken up with after the 7-month relationship that I thought I was going to marry the guy. And I was in a really, this was like my lowest point, which I've mentioned this to you guys before, but like this is where I would want to start my book. And it was during this time that one of my best friends, who happened to be somebody I worked with at the bar, I couldn't go anywhere or do anything without talking about this relationship that I had been in and this guy. And like, I was so scared that I was going to see him around. And I was carrying a lot of shame about the relationship and that I had stayed with this person that now I felt was like a really bad dude. And she was like, oh my God, you can't keep doing this. I need you to read this book, The Untethered Soul by Michael A. Singer. She had actually told me about it numerous times, but now that I was going through this, she was like, it felt like it wasn't an option. She's like, I'm not asking you to read this book. I'm not telling you because it's cool. Like, you have to read this book. And I was just so lost that I was like, fine, I'll read this book, this stupid book. So there is a chapter in the middle of the book that floored me. And it's where he talks about inner thorns. It's not about the book is not about like losing weight or like having a problem with the scale, but it felt like he was talking to me specifically. And he said something to the effect of, your inner thorn is the thing that you think about when you wake up in the morning and the thing that you think about before you go to bed at night. And I swear to God, I gasped and I put the book down and I started pacing. And I was just like, that is how I feel about my weight. Like as soon as I wake up, it's all I'm thinking about. And when I go to bed at night, it's all I'm thinking about. And as soon as I put that together about these inner thorns, I said, I cannot keep living like this. And I didn't know how I was going to do it. And it was really scary, but I knew that I could not continue to live like this. And that's when I made the decision that I had to move away from the people that I loved and the place that I loved, because I wanted to transform my life and I couldn't transform my life if I stayed there. So the reason that I'm sharing all this is because JR writes so beautifully about his own bar and all the people and how much love and happiness was inside of it. But at the same time, I could feel the heaviness of it, the sadness of it, because there's a lot of downsides to drinking. And it's not good for anybody. And this book is not about drinking or sobering up, although he does stop drinking for good by the end. It's certainly the underlying current of the book. And for my memoir, I've been thinking about how I'm on this journey where I've drastically cut back on drinking. So I used to drink a bottle of wine a night, maybe 5 glasses, maybe 6 glasses, plus shots of Jameson. This year, so it's September now, in the past 9 months, I've drank 14 times. I know that because I've kept a note in my phone because I was just curious to see how many days I would drink this year. So that's less than 2 days a month. I also don't like feeling drunk anymore. So I haven't really drank that much on those days. So I don't want my memoir to be about my journey to stop drinking completely if that's where I end up, but it's certainly a big part of it. And I've been wondering about how to how to do that or how to write about it. And this book showed me that I can do that and how I can do that. I finished this book weeks ago. In fact, I've read two memoirs since then. I've read Love Warrior by Glennon Doyle and Born Standing Up by Steve Martin. So those will be the ones I'm doing next. But it took me a really long time to get to this point. First of all, because I think you guys know, I don't read on a Kindle. I've tried it and I just can't. I don't enjoy it. I really love reading an actual book. And so because I don't read on a Kindle and I can't just like highlight and take notes that way, I literally underline what I like in the book. And then once I'm finished the book, I sit down at my computer, I open up the book, I have one of those little weight things that I put on top, and I open up my Evernote and I just start typing everything that I've highlighted. The problem was with this one is that I highlighted the whole freaking book and it took me forever to transcribe it. I ended up getting 17 pages of notes. And while I was writing, I kept stopping because it sent me down a rabbit hole for my old blog that I used to write. Because I wrote a blog under my real name before I became Charlie. And part of the time that I wrote this other blog was when I was working at the Masonry. So I actually have a lot of blog posts about the bar and about the people. Lots of specifics and details that if I were to recall them now, I would definitely not remember. So it was really fun to go back and read about my old life when I was such a mess. And I was so open about it. And I thought that it was cool. I really did. I thought that, I know, not the drugs. I didn't write about the drugs. But I thought that like getting drunk and blacking out, like there was nothing wrong with that. Anyway, so what I eventually got to was I cut down the 17 pages of notes to 11. And then since I just recorded this and now I'm recording now again, I've cut it down even more. Like I really am only trying to share the stuff with you that I have a really good takeaway from. So that's what I'm going to try to do today. Okay. The first group of notes are going to be about drinking and the bar and the men, because as I said, that's the stuff that resonated with me the most. All right, let's get to it. In chapter 12, he's still a kid here. And as a kid, the men of the bar, including his Uncle Charlie is like a prominent figure, older adult male figure in his life. And they would take him to this beach called Gilgo Beach, which was right next to the Gilgo Bar. And so here he is describing the Gilgo Bar. He writes, "The Gilgo Bar was nothing but a fly-blown bait shack with a gritty floor and one long conga line of dusty bottles, but the men strode through the door as though it were the Waldorf. They had a deep abiding respect for bars, all bars, and for the decorum of bars. The first thing they did was buy a round for the house, three old fishermen and a leather-faced lady with a cleft palate. Then they bought a round for themselves. With the first taste of cold beer and Bloody Marys, the men began to behave differently. Their limbs seemed looser, their laughter more lively. The bait shack shook with their guffaws, and I could see their hangovers lifting from them like the morning fog lifting off the ocean." So here we are seeing the effects of alcohol on men from the eyes of a kid. It's a very happy, fun, loving, entertaining kind of image. And I didn't share what he wrote before, but on the drive to the bar, Uncle Charlie is like stopping at all these men's houses to pick them up. And they're all so hungover. They're all miserable, cranky. They're not talking a lot. And so we got to see the before picture of this dichotomy of how miserable they were and now how happy they are. I felt a little bit depressed reading this. There's this vicious cycle that happens with drinking. Like you're so hungover, you're so miserable that the only thing that will make you feel better is to start drinking again. So some things to note here. First is just the way he describes things. And I'm going to say this a lot, but he does not use cliches. He has very vivid imagery. So he wrote one long conga line of dusty bottles. It really just like created an image in my head of what is on the inside of this bar. And I love how he says they strode through the door as though it were the Waldorf. I love how he's talking about this, like it's this little tiny shack with nothing. Like it's just so dirty and gross. And they're walking through it like it's this like fancy hotel. Again, it just created such an image of my mind of how they looked walking through the door. And then at the very end, he said, their hangovers lifting from them like the morning fog lifting off the ocean. That was really great too, because they are about to go to the ocean right after this trip. There's some other things too here that are, it's really interesting when you read a paragraph like this and I'm like, oh my God, this makes me sad and I relate to it and I totally get it. But also like he's doing these specific things like repetition. He said they had a deep respect for bars, all bars and the decorum of bars. So you've got bars three in a row in that sentence. And then we've got some alliteration. We've got some B alliteration here. Ready? Cold beer, Bloody Marys, began to behave differently. And then their limbs seemed looser, their laughter more lively. What? Like how, these are things that on the first pass, I don't notice them. But then when I dissect it, it's like really good imagery, repetition, and alliteration. I have a whole section on alliteration and we're going to get to it, but I had to note it here too. All right, let's move on. In chapter 30, oh, and by the way, I'm bouncing all over the place because right now I'm just doing a section on the like the drinking in the bar, but we're going to move all over the book. All right, so we're in chapter 30. He is working at the New York Times. He's just like a copy boy at this point, and he had a really bad day at work. He's feeling completely humiliated, and he writes, "The train to Manhasset broke down in the freight yards just outside Penn Station. The lights died, and we didn't move again for 2 hours. Sitting in the dark, I replayed my day over and over. When the train finally got underway, when I reached the front door to Publicans, it was about 8:30, and I didn't walk through the door. I dove." Again, this was one of those passages that I was just like, oh my God, I relate to this so much. So anytime something horrible happened for me, which at that time in my life was mostly boy related, sometimes acting related, especially when I was single. Oh my God, I was a total mess when I was single. I would run to the bar to tell everyone. Like I could not stand to think about any of it. It was all so mortifying. Like I could not be alone with my thoughts because I was just wanted to die of humiliation. I needed commentary that wasn't my own. I needed other voices besides the critical one in my head. And I needed alcohol. It wasn't like I just wanted to go home and drink. Like I really wanted to go to the bar to drink and be around all of these people. Okay, here. Yeah, I am skipping all over the place with the alliteration. So I love the alliteration here. I didn't door dove. I didn't walk through the door. I dove. I love the way this sounds at the end. It gave such a punch. I don't know if this sounds simple to you. Like, oh, alliteration, yeah, does that really make a difference? But I'm telling you, there everything through this book, it's like repetition and alliteration just keep coming up over and over again in passages that I loved. Okay, and now he's been at the bar now for a little bit. He's drinking, he's having a good time. He writes, "Now I was wedged between Uncle Charlie and Banker. The beer was cold, the subject was words, and I was so happy that I didn't ever want to move. I laughed and threw an arm around Uncle Charlie's neck and told him I felt great. No, better than great. Great. I told him I had not been feeling great a short while ago, but now I felt great." Okay, let me talk about the actual lines we just read. The way it's written as if he's talking to Uncle Charlie when he's drunk. He says that he told him I felt great. No, better than great. Great. So you can see that the great with five R's, by the way, like that is him feeling good, slurring his words, drunk. You know, he wouldn't write it like that unless he was inebriated. So I love how he writes it like he's drunk. And then the repetition in this is so great. Oh my God, I just said great, and I'm talking about the word great. So he says, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 greats. So he says, "Told him I felt great. No, better than great. Great. I had not been feeling great a short while ago, but now I felt great." This is not the kind of rhythmic repetition we like from that prologue opening. It's not the redundant kind that we don't like either. This is the kind of repetition that a drunk person uses, which is hilarious. So I love how repetition can be used in so many different ways, and JR shows us how to do them in the different ways so beautifully. Really quick, I also want to talk about the M dash. My dude JR loves an M dash. I know that you can't see the M dash as I'm reading this, but there are M dashes everywhere in his book. I realized reading this book that I wasn't using the M dash correctly. I never knew like if I was supposed to put a space. I think I've done it right sometimes, but not all the time. So I'm always surprised when in rite of passage, if I'm like reading a student's essays, I'm always surprised when I read people's writing and they use quotations wrong. I feel like this is such a easy thing to know how to do. Like, if you want to know how to use quotations correctly, like, just read something by somebody who you trust and admire and do it like they do. And here I am doing M dashes wrong. But anyway, so the M dash that he used in this passage was, but now I felt M dash great. It's just like a little emphasis on the word great. And then before that, in the passage before, I didn't walk through the door, M dash, I dove. Again, is the same. It was similar for both those lines where it's like this emphasis on that and that punch on the last thing that he's going to say. Okay, on page 349, this is kind of along with the storyline of his father. So I haven't talked about his dad yet, really. He was absent for most of his childhood. And in fact, he almost killed his mom when he was a baby. His dad is meeting him here. And now he's like in his 20s. And apparently his dad has been sober, but he surprises him by ordering a drink. So he writes, I was alarmed at first, but by the time my father had enjoyed half a cocktail, he'd begun to enjoy me. Suddenly, he was responsive. He was listening. More, he was offering advice, making me laugh, doing his funny voices. Before my eyes, he was turning into a different man, into one of the men at Publicans, and so I urged him to enjoy another cocktail. Hell, I told the waitress, as if the thought had just occurred to me, I think I'd enjoy a cocktail myself. This feels a little bit like a callback, and I actually have a section on callbacks that we're going to get to soon, but he references the men. So he was turning into a different man, into one of the men at Publicans. And this feels very similar to the way he described the men at Gilgo Bar. And similar to that passage that I didn't read the before the passage, like the dichotomy of how the men were acting, like grumpy and cranky and quiet and brooding and miserable. And then when they had a Bloody Mary, they started to get more lively and friendly and happy. Here, before his dad orders a cocktail, he's like, has nothing to say. He's got his head down. And then after he has a cocktail, he starts to open up more and be and listen and be responsive and do his funny voices. And it's very similar to the way he felt with the men at Publicans. Okay, a little bit further down the page, he writes, I knew the cocktails were the cause of our newfound closeness. But so what? Cocktails helped us relax and overcome whatever guilt we felt about loving each other. Cocktails made it possible for us to forget all that he'd done and all that he hadn't. What objection could there be to cocktails if they could accomplish all that? So this reminds me of the way I feel about drinking with my family. It feels like drinking is the only way in, like to have a real conversation. And in fact, the 14 days that I've drank this year have all been with my family. Well, to be fair, I haven't really hung out with any friends this year, which is kind of weird, I guess. But actually, there was one time that I drank with friends in New York City in January. But everything else was with family. But anyway, this little passage here, I don't know if you noticed, but there's that repetition again. He says cocktails. I knew that cocktails were the cause for our newfound closeness. Cocktails helped us relax. Cocktails made it possible. What objection could there be to cocktails if they could accomplish all that? You know, again, I cannot believe how much repetition is coming up. When I first made this, repetition wasn't even on my list of things to talk about. And then it just like happens to be that every single thing that I like, he uses repetition. Pretty cool. Okay, and then in the epilogue, this is the very end. I loved his epilogue. It's 11 years later, and there's an event that happens. In this case, it's 9/11. So he's been away from, and his town is in Long Island, so it's like right close to New York City. So this event brings him back to Manhasset and to the men and to the bar. And one of the men has died in the towers, and he's sitting at the bar with one of his friends and he's drinking ginger ale. And his friend asks how long he hasn't been drinking and he tells him 10 years. He writes, I didn't go into a long explanation. I didn't want to list all the reasons that drinking, along with smoking and gambling and most other vices, had lost its appeal after I left Publicans. I didn't want to tell Jimbo that sobering up had felt like growing up and vice versa. But the main reason I didn't say anything to Jimbo was that I didn't want to profane Publicans. In the wake of September 11th, I felt grateful for every minute I'd spent in that bar, even the ones I regretted. Again, I have to talk about the Masonry. I loved the Masonry so much, and like JR, I was so grateful to everything that place gave me. Okay, so the repetition here, I didn't go into a long explanation. I didn't want to list the reasons. I didn't want to tell Jimbo. I didn't say anything to Jimbo because I didn't want to profane Publicans. Isn't that so cool? I mean, I'm wondering if you guys are picking this up as I'm saying it, but I don't ever notice this. Not ever. A lot of times I don't notice this until after the fact. This line really hit me in the gut. Sobering up had felt like growing up. Whoa. I feel that too. I have felt that a lot in the years that I have been slowing down and not drinking as much. I really have grown a lot in these past few years. When I thought about writing my own memoir, I wasn't sure how much I was going to include about the bar, except for obviously the opening image where you see me at my worst. Reading this book has made me think more about the impact that bar and the people had in my life, and I'm wondering if maybe it's a bigger part of my story. I'm not sure. All right, let's talk about alliteration and analogies. First, we're going to talk about alliteration. And in this first passage, this might be a little bit confusing, but the bar was called Publicans, but it changed, the name changed during the book. So it was first called Dickens, and then the bar name changed to Publicans. So here, it's Dickens. So he writes, "At 8 years old, I began to dream of going to Dickens as other boys dream of visiting Disneyland." I think this is so fucking good. Like, okay, one, Dickens and Disneyland is your alliteration. They both start with D. Dickens is a bar. It's a dark, depressing place for drunks and old men. Disneyland is a bright, magical place for families and children. So they are polar opposites. So when you have a stark contrast with two words that start with the same sound or letter, that, my friends, is a banger. He does it again. Here's another example. Page 41. Dickens sounded both silly and sinister, like a children's birthday party on a pirate ship. Okay? Silly and sinister. Two S's and opposites. Silly and sinister. And then he follows it with the analogy, like a children's birthday party on a pirate ship. He did this in his in that article I told you guys about Prince Harry. He says, it wasn't a problem, it was a perk. Problem and perk. So good. Okay, I got to pause here. I want to talk more about alliteration. For a rite of passage, I sometimes run sessions, my own sessions, about kind of like whatever I want to do. And last cohort, I had to run a session on playful writing. And so I decided to do the whole session on alliteration. Here's what I think. I think that alliteration is underused and undervalued. For this cohort, I think I'm going to be doing it again. I'm not positive yet, but I think. And I was trying to think about what I'm going to do for my playful session. And I was thinking of doing alliteration again because I just love it so much. The other reason that I want to do it is because there's such a wide spectrum of writers coming to this course. Some people are like me. They're going to write really personal things. And so they can be very playful in their writing. There are some writers, lots of writers, who have a more like formal, businessy approach. You know, they're not writing it for, you know, it's not like a diary for them. They're writing, you know, important things. Not to say that personal stuff isn't important, but you know what I'm saying. You know, you can only be so playful in their type of writing. And so if I'm going to do a session on, you know, inserting pop culture references into your writing, like, you know, maybe some people are like, yeah, I don't really want to do that. Also, by the way, like pop culture references, it's not that easy to just insert a pop culture reference into your writing. Alliteration is so easy to implement, and I want there to be the least amount of friction in the sessions that I'm running. And two, everybody can use it. So I think that this is a gold mine, but I mentioned it to Sam and I said, I think I'm going to do another session on alliteration. And he was like, really? Alliteration? Like, can't you just like say like, yeah, use alliteration. There you go. See you later. Like, how much is there really to say about alliteration? My thinking is that, yeah, sure, you can say that. And then you can have it in your head, like as a student, like, oh yeah, alliteration, that's something to use. But unless you're like really seeing it in action, you're seeing all these examples and you're experiencing it yourself, what it feels like to use alliteration and how it can change your writing, I don't think it's going to be like, you're not going to really learn it and use it until you have somebody like in a session like mine showing you how beautiful it can be, how great it can be, how much fun it can be, all that kind of stuff. So I'm talking about this now because I'm wondering how you guys feel about this. Like, if I were to do a session on playful writing, would you want to come to a session on alliteration? Or is there something else that comes to your mind that you're like, actually, I'd really like to learn about this? I don't know, breaking the fourth wall, whatever. All right, let's move on. to analogies. I'm going to read three analogies in the row. This is from chapter 12, and these are actually all on the same page. Okay. I watched him straighten the rear view, tenderly, as if pushing a lock of hair from the face of someone he loved. I sat on the high middle bump of the back seat, like a prince being pulled in a rickshaw. And then one more. He was in pain, shielding his eyes like a prisoner being released from solitary confinement. And there he was describing somebody who was hungover, which is really funny. So when you use analogies like this, it's so visual. And JR does this throughout the book. He makes it look easy, but it's not only a way to avoid cliche, it's a way to bring your writing to life. I think that it's really difficult to just incorporate analogies into your writing. It's like, oh yeah, just do an analogy here. It's like, yeah, but then it feels forced and it's like, I'd rather not even use it at all. So I think about this as instead of trying to come up with an analogy, try to think of a more specific way to describe what you're trying to say. I'm going to give you an example. Sam and I and the kids, we went on this trip and we stopped over and did like this glamping thing in a teepee. And anyway, we were me and Sam and our kids. So they're like 3 and 1.5. We are all staying in the same room. And so Layla goes to bed first. She's the youngest one. And so we have their pack and plays right next to each other and our beds right next to them. So it's like, we're all together. And my 3-year-old George, like he's 3. So he's just like running around. He doesn't understand that like Layla's trying to go to bed. So he needs to be quiet. So Layla is in her pack and play in her little sleep sack. And she's just standing and she's just laughing at George. And she's just, you know, she thinks that she's just part of the fun and playing. She's getting really tired. Like she usually goes to sleep at 7 and now it's 8 o'clock and she's still just laughing, but she's getting so tired that she just like, she'll get down on her knees and she'll kind of crawl around the pack and play and then she'll pull herself up and she looks drunk. And I'm looking at her and I'm like, oh my God, she looks drunk. And then I'm like, no, that's not it. She doesn't look drunk. Like that's too easy. That's too general. It's more specific than that. What does she look like? She's really reminding me of something right now. And then I was like, oh my God, that's it. She looks like a boxer who won't stay down. You know what I mean? Like the boxer that's just been hit so many times over so many rounds. And it's like, dude, stay down. Just stay down, dude. And they keep getting back up. That was Layla. She's like a fighter or a boxer who wouldn't go down. And I knew that this worked too, because we were on our way to visit my family and I was relaying the story about Layla. And I told different family members at different times about her being like a boxer who wouldn't stay down. And I got such a big laugh out of it. And this is a good way to test this stuff. And again, I didn't have to come up with that. I just really looked at her and I was like, okay, what is this really reminding me of? Okay. This next one is a metaphor that I really liked. And there's some other stuff in here too. Let me just read this to you. On page 67, I'm back to college life. He's at Yale. And he had this specific tree that he always sat under on college campus. And he's having a pretty hard time at college right now. He writes, "Just before finals, sitting under my elm and observing its spidery roots as they radiated from me in every direction, I concluded that this was what I lacked, roots. To do well at Yale, you needed a foundation, some basic knowledge to draw upon, as the elm drew water through its roots. I had none. Frankly, I wasn't even sure this tree was an elm." So when I read this last part, "Frankly, I wasn't even sure this tree was an elm," I laughed so hard. And so then I just wrote, why was this so funny? Why was this so funny? And the thing that is so funny, I realize, is that his world, it feels like it's crumbling. He's lost. The best part about this is that he's feeling sorry for himself. And it's always funny when a writer is feeling sorry for himself, for me. And all this time, he's had this one thing that he came to, that like his trusty old tree, his elm. And he's sitting under this elm. And then he's like, and I might even be wrong about that. I just love this. It's not only the metaphor, but it's the humor because he's feeling sorry for himself. Okay, side note about commas. My dude rarely uses commas. It's crazy. Like you would not believe how often he doesn't use a comma. You'd be like, oh, I thought there would be a comma there. My friend Adam, we call him the comma killer. If you ever send him an essay for him to edit, just know he is going to slash your commas to the point that you're going to be like, yep, that was, why did I put that comma in there with some? And then with some, you're going to be like, I'm pretty sure that's comma. But now reading this, I'm just like, okay, well, JR never uses commas. Even, you're not even going to believe this. This last sentence that was so funny, frankly, I wasn't even sure this tree was an elm. He doesn't put a comma after frankly. That's right. So I Googled words at the start of a sentence like frankly, comma, however, because I wasn't sure what those words were called. I'm really good at Googling. And then when I Googled that, the word transition words came up. And I'm like, oh, they're called transition words. So then I Googled transition words at the start of a sentence. And then I like could not think of anything besides frankly and however. And then I Googled this and it's like, furthermore, moreover, in addition to. Okay, you get the picture. So then I Googled, do transition words need a comma after them? And then one of the things I pulled up says this. Use a comma after transition words and phrases that begin a sentence. Source, Nova Southeastern University. Okay, well, what does Nova Southeastern University know? I don't know. But basically, they're saying that you are supposed to put a comma after, frankly. And then I found something else. Let me read this. Use commas to separate independent clauses when they are joined by any of these seven coordinating conjunctions, and, but, for, or, nor, so, yet. So, example, I love vanilla ice cream, comma, but my brother prefers chocolate. That is wrong, people. That is wrong. JR would not put a comma after ice cream. My question to you is, where are we supposed to be getting our information from? Not the internet. I'll tell you from where. We should be learning how to write from people we know how to write, okay? So, do you need a comma after frankly? No, you don't. Do you know how I know? Because JR doesn't use one. Am I saying that you shouldn't put a comma after frankly? No, you do whatever you want, whatever you feel comfortable with. You know, I think it's a choice is what I'm saying. And so I'm gonna think about that the next time I write frankly or any of those transition words. All right, this is really fun. I wanna talk about foreshadowing and callbacks. Okay, let me explain. Foreshadowing, and again, this is just my interpretation. I don't know what the real answers are. Foreshadowing is when the writer hints at future events and it creates suspense. A callback is a relevant reference to something that took place earlier in the narrative. This begs the question, are foreshadowing, I looked up an article on foreshadowing and callbacks. So I'm pulling this question from this article that I read. This writer asked, are foreshadowing and callbacks merely descriptions of the same technique from opposite sides? And I think the answer is no. So let me give you an example of foreshadowing. Okay, here we go. On page 247, he writes, even Steve, who loved Joey D, lost patience now and then. At least once he'd summoned Joey D to the basement and told him to grow up. You can't be acting this way in a bar room, Steve said. It depresses people. Time to be a man, Joey D. Be a man. When I heard about Steve calling Joey D on the carpet, I shuddered. I'd rather be put on the rack, I thought, than summoned to the basement by Steve and lectured on manhood. Okay, so I read this passage, and then in the margin I wrote, foreshadowing, ? And the question that I want to know is, will JR be called to the basement by Steve and lectured on manhood? And the answer is yes. 12 chapters later, he hadn't been paying his tab at the bar, or he had been, but the checks weren't going through or something. So he writes, just after I returned from the Hugo apartment, Steve summoned me to his basement office. Junior, he said, leaning back in his creaky old desk chair, we all miss the float once in a while, but this is no good, no good at all. This isn't the kind of man you want to be. His words echoed in the basement and in my head. Okay, so this was foreshadowed. It was a very subtle way, though, that the way he did it. He doesn't bring much attention to the fact that he never wanted to be called down to Steve's office. He says his words echoed in the basement and in my head. So in the first passage, back on page 247, he says he's talking to Joey D and he says, time to be a man, Joey D, be a man. And then here in chapter 42, he's saying to JR, this isn't the kind of man you want to be. So it's not the exact same thing, but it's another way of saying the same thing. And I think that this is treating your audience like they're smart, like they're geniuses. This is what I talked about with Alex DeBranco in my conversation with him. He is addressing the fact that this has been foreshadowed, but he's doing it in a subtle way. Now, could you also call this a callback to what happened before? I'm not sure. I'm going to say no. I think this is like, oh, this was foreshadowed, period. All right, now let me show you the difference between, this is going to make it clearer for you with the callback. Okay, this is on page 24. And he's talking about his mother back when he was a kid. He writes, "Her most inspired lie marked a watershed in our relationship because it concerned my most cherished possession, my security blanket. Made of mint green satin quilted with thick white thread, the blanket was my other addiction. I grew edgy when it was out of reach. I wore it as a poncho, a sash, a scarf, and sometimes a bridal train. I regarded my blanket as a loyal friend in a cruel world, while my mother saw it as an adult emotional disorder in the making. Seven was too old for a security blanket, she said, trying to reason with me. But when did reason stand a chance against obsessive love? She tried seizing the blanket, but I howled as though she were hacking off my arm at the joint. Finally, I woke one night to find her on the edge of my bed. What's wrong? I asked. Nothing. Go back to sleep. Over the next few weeks, I noticed my security blanket getting smaller. I asked my mother. Maybe it's shrinking in the wash, she said. I'll use colder water. Many years later, I learned that my mother had crept into my room each night and taken a scissor to my security blanket, snipping off an imperceptible slice until it became a security shawl, a security washcloth, a security swatch. Over time, there would be more security blankets, people and ideas, and particularly places to which I would form unhealthy attachments. Whenever life snatched one from me, I would recall how gently my mother pared away my first." So here, he's telling this little story about his security blanket. And then at the end, it becomes a metaphor. Publicans turns into a security blanket as well. Now, the thing here is, there is no question that's lingering in my mind. Okay, he's already telling us that Publicans is going to become a security blanket. So I'm not wondering, oh, what's going to happen? I know. So then on page 157, so this is 17 chapters later, he writes, "Sending me to Manhasset, urging me to bond with Uncle Charlie and the men, my mother had been weaning me from her and herself from me by imperceptible degrees. It might have been the fleecy clouds streaming by the window of the plane that made me understand. My mother had subtly, secretly snipped away a sliver of herself every summer. Thereafter, I'd have to contend with all security blankets by myself. And none would be more secure or more smothering than Steve's bar." So here is the callback to the security blanket. And the way a callback feels, it feels like you're coming full circle and you didn't even know you needed to. Callbacks feel like a pat on the back or like an inside joke. It's like, we know what's going on because we were here from the beginning. Foreshadowing feels like an answer to a question. Okay, something JR does a bunch is he will write about missed opportunities where he wanted to say something or he felt like he should have said something but didn't. This stands out to me like three times. I had them all written down, but I'm only going to talk about one. The one I'm going to talk about is writing about his dad, but he also had a moment where he did this with his mom where he felt like he missed a moment that he should have said something to her. And then a friend, I think Jimbo, he wanted to tell him how much he meant to him and he just didn't. So let me give you the example with his dad. He writes, "Driving him to the airport, I tried to think of something profound to say. Before we parted, I thought we should address the topic we'd been avoiding. But how? My father turned up the volume on the car stereo and sang along with my Sinatra cassette as I ran through different speeches in my head. I thought I might confront him. Why did you leave my mother and me without a penny? Or I might take a forgiving tone, suggest we start over. Look, the past is the past, and I hope we can put it all behind us. Whatever I said needed to be clever, but also serious. And struggling to find the right words to strike the exact tone, I stopped paying attention to the road." So you can see the struggle in his mind, and then nothing actually happened. He doesn't even say a word to his dad. This got me thinking about different moments in my life where I have felt something but didn't say it. One example is my wedding. My dad gave a speech and he gives this whole speech. He cries. And the whole time I am sitting there waiting for him to say something about me. I'm like, what is he going to say about me? What does he think about me? What does he know about me? Because I don't know. And finally he ends the speech and he says, about Sam. He says, he's perfect for my daughter. He says, or they're perfect for each other. And then everybody's applauding and like acting like it's like the nicest thing ever. But he did not say one word about me. All he said was they're perfect for each other. What the fuck does that even mean? So then right after his speech, we have our father-daughter dance. And I'm feeling like a lot of feelings. I'm feeling angry. I'm feeling hurt. I'm feeling like this kind of like realization / sadness that like, oh, my dad just like doesn't really know me at all. And we start dancing and he's like, how was it? So what do you think? And you could just tell. I mean, I could tell that he was looking for approval. He wanted to know that he did a good job. And so I told him I told him it was good. But I was like, I wanted to say something else. I just didn't. Like, I don't know if JR knew. Well, I think in some instances he wished he said something and didn't. But in some instances, it's like, you're trying so hard to figure out what to say, and it's too hard to say something. My example is not the same thing as JR's. But it's still this. My point is that even if you don't make the moment what you want it to be, it's still a moment you can write about. Because it's like, okay, like, how did I grow because of that moment? Or how can I grow now because of that moment? In the documentary Stutz, which I love, psychiatrist Phil Stutz says, you need to look at all events as having value. If you can do that, then you're in a zone of tremendous opportunity. So there are no moments that you can't write about. No matter what happened, there's still a way to write about it. There's so many different perspectives to still write about that moment. So this just felt like that extra permission to do so. Okay, this is so good. This is the end of a chapter, chapter 32. I haven't mentioned this, but JR hated his name because he was named after his dad and his dad wasn't in the picture. He was even close to legally changing his name at one point, and then it doesn't happen, pretty much because he got drunk one night and just like fucked up. But yeah, he really wanted to change his name. In this section I'm about to read, it's the end of the chapter, it's the last lines of the chapter, and it's Uncle Charlie speaking to JR about this famous boxer. So this is the quote from Uncle Charlie on page 271. Did you know Hagler legally changed his name to Marvelous? Why would a man with all his money go to the trouble of legally changing his name? Is something so silly? What would possess a man to do such a thing, JR? Why would he give a shit? What? Why are you looking at me like that? Oh my God, I thought this was so fucking good. Like, okay, so many things. I love how this is the last lines of the chapter. Like, there's no response to this. You know, I love that JR doesn't respond or say even what he's thinking, or he doesn't respond to Uncle Charlie. It's just Uncle Charlie saying it. So it's like we're seeing JR's face from Uncle Charlie's perspective, or like we're seeing Uncle Charlie's face from JR's perspective. I am totally stealing this. So I think I can't figure out how or where at what point, but all I have to think about is, has there been a moment? And the answer is yes. Has there been a moment when someone was talking to me about someone else, but it felt like they were talking about me? And then I can do it just like this. This is fucking gold. This is good stuff. Okay, here is a writing lesson that he gives us. Okay, so something that JR struggles with throughout his early life is that he always tries to sound smart, and he always uses big words when he writes. So he kind of befriends this priest that he always sees on the train, and he's talking to the priest, and the priest says this to him on page 202. Do you know why God invented writers? Because he loves a good story, and he doesn't give a damn about words. Words are the curtain we've hung between him and our true selves. Try not to think about the words. Don't strain for the perfect sentence. There's no such thing. Writing is guesswork. Every sentence is an educated guess, the reader's as much as yours. So I love how he gives us this little writing lesson in here. Sam tells me that this is my superpower, actually. I do not try to write perfect sentences. Therefore, I don't write perfect sentences, and therefore I sound like myself. Sam knows this because he does try to craft perfect sentences all the time. And when people craft a perfect sentence, or they really try their hardest to craft a perfect sentence, it feels too formal or like they're trying too hard. And the thing about perfect sentences is they don't allow your voice to shine through. And voice is something that we're all trying to achieve, I think, in writing. And it's one of those elusive things, like how do we get our voice? How do we get our voice? I think you just write like yourself. And it's really hard to write like yourself if you are agonizing over each and individual sentence. Just let it go. Let it flow. Okay. On page 254, I just thought this was pretty funny. I'm going to share this. He writes, weeks later, I sat at a bar with Cager and told him I was working up a new theory about publicans. I was hungry and lonely on Thanksgiving. Publicans fed me. I was depressed about being Mr. Salty. Publicans distracted me. I had always thought of publicans as a sanctuary, but now I believed it was something else altogether. Publicans is the Aladdin's lamp of Long Island, I said. Make a wish, give the bar a rub, and presto, Aladdin, aka Publicans, provides. So, So he's like on this Aladdin kick for a while. He's workshopping his writing ideas. And then he's sharing them as part of the story. And he's putting them in the book. It made me laugh because it made me think, like, he probably looked back on this and was like, oh my God, this was the dumbest idea ever. But he put it in. And so that made me feel really good as a writer. It's like, yeah, we're going to have lots of bad ideas. And then the ones, you know, the one that works and the ones that sticks will shine through. But like, you have to go through this process. And this made me think about Alex DeBranco's suggestion for my memoir to be about me writing a memoir. I imagine the cover of my book and it's called "I'm Writing a Memoir" with an exclamation point. And then throughout the book, I'm like writing about all the different ways to write my memoir and what it's going to be about. I don't think I'm actually going to do that, but it's funny to think about. But anyway, yeah, it's like, I just love this added layer of like letting us into the process of how he's like growing as a writer. Okay, we are at the end. I have one note about the acknowledgments section that I wanted to share. On page 370, he writes, "I owe special thanks to Harvard professor John Stopher, who gave me a list of rare old memoirs to read, then sat with me in his campus office through long winter afternoons and explained to me the American memoir. Those were among the most pleasant hours of my life." What? Like, I read this and I was like, what? Okay, I so badly want to see this list. JR, if you are listening, can you imagine? Okay, now I'm nervous that he's actually listening to this. I am delusional. Okay, JR, if you are listening, would you mind sharing some of these books? I mean, not like the actual books, but like the list. I can get the books myself. Or maybe I can't. Maybe I can't because they're rare old memoirs to read. But, oh my God, I'm so curious. Like, this is what I'm doing. I am trying to read memoirs and learn from memoirs so that I can write my own. And it's like, I feel like I'm missing out on this, like, secret stash that's hiding somewhere in the world. So, I can't believe you're listening. Thanks for being here. Regardless of whether or not you share your list, thank you for writing a beautiful book about a bar.